Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Red Wednesday, and with my co-host Adam Wybray, today I'll be talking about The Haunting of Elizabeth Cray by Chris Wooding. There will be a full transcript of this episode available, so check the episode description if you want to see that. Enjoy! Hi Adam.
Hello.
This feels quite early to be doing a recording, but I'm sure we'll manage.
Well, don't worry, because I didn't get much sleep last night, so I'm ready.
Great. The Haunting of Elizabeth Cray was my suggestion, because it's a book that I read when I was a kid, and that has stuck in my memory as one of the scariest books I've ever read.
I'm impressed you read it as a kid. There is no way I would have got through this as a kid. Like, you know, if I tried reading this before, even 14 would have been a push. Like, yeah, if I tried reading this before 16 or something, I wouldn't have got through it, to be honest.
Yeah, it came out in 2001, so I think I must have been 12 or 13 when I was reading it. And it's a scary, scary
book. It's pretty nasty. it goes there.
it does. So I didn't remember very much about it from having read it back then.
So what did you remember?
I remembered Stitchface, who is the serial killer character. I didn't remember that he's called Stitchface. I just remembered that there was a horrifying serial killer, and I remembered specifically part of the rhyme.
Oh.
Okay, so there's, I'll give a description in a moment, but one of the witchkin, which is the monsters in the books, is called Rawhead, and he follows behind you at night, you hear an extra footstep as you walk, and if you turn around three times, then he appears and kills you. And there's a rhyme, and it says, "Rawhead close behind you treads, three looks back and you'll be dead, but close your eyes and count to 10, and Rawhead will be gone again." And I remembered the second half of that rhyme. And I often thought about it when I was walking at night by myself.
And presumably walking through London. I mean, that's going to be, very much a book set in London. And so I did feel that maybe for you growing up in London, it would be quite a different experience reading it for me, who's only ever gone really as a tourist to London or when I've stayed with you.
Yeah, it definitely had definitely locations I recognised and sort of felt a connection with it in that way. So give some context. It's set in a kind of alternate timeline Victorian London, in which 20 years before the start of the story, Britain was badly bombed by the Prussians. Now, after this bombing, which is called the Vernichtung, which means destruction in German, nightmare creatures called witchkin started to appear in the cities, but particularly in London.
And they're much worse than other kin.
Yes, they are, yeah. And they overrun the old quarter of the city by night. They only come out at night. And one of our main characters, Thaniel, is a witch hunter, and he's one of the few people who have any means of dealing with the witchkin. And our title character, Elizabeth, is a girl that he finds in great distress when he's out hunting, and she's lost all memory of who she is. there's quite a lot of plot to this book, and I will try to explain as we go along.
Yeah, I did think as to how nimbly we're going to have to step around spoilers.
I think we can't.
I mean, that's always going to be an issue when you start with an amnesia plot line, basically. Which I think is actually handled quite well in this book. I'm always a bit sniffy about amnesia as a kind of convenient plot device, particularly as someone who's played quite a lot of interactive fiction and used a lot in old interactive fiction like Infocom as a useful means of withholding information.
Yes.
But I think it allows you to... You're aligned with Eliza Bell's perspective enough that it kind of works, I think. Like, it doesn't feel just, like, wholly abstracted in the plot device. You know, it feeds into her character in a way that's quite convincing. So I didn't mind it too much here.
Yeah, I feel like there's definitely quite a few tropes in this, used in this book, but I think they're used pretty well, and it kind of avoids maybe some of the more sort of lurid or sensational aspects in a way.
Yeah, we'll have to get on to that.
I'm thinking about the asylum and...
Yeah, in a way. I think it's similar to Neil Gaiman's stuff. Like, it reminded me of Neverwhere quite a lot. Obviously, partly creeping underneath London stuff and the idea of a kind of secret society of undesirables living sort of, you know, in bondage in name only, that it's got a somewhat romanticised portrait of what it is to be homeless in a way that Neverwhere also does.
Yeah. Are you talking about the sort of society of the beggars?
Yeah, and, you know, have a lot of camaraderie and are pictured having a lot of good times and feasting and drinking and are supposedly very wealthy, even though this is Victorian era London. So clearly this is a major kind of divergence from real world Victorian London.
I see what you mean. It reminded me kind of Discworld, like Terry Pratchett.
I can see that.
Where they have like the Fool's Guild and the Thieves Guild and so on. But it's done for more dramatic effect in this book.
Yeah, it's slightly less satirical, perhaps, than in the Discworld books. I mean, talking about the plotting, the thing that made me think most of was a very good D&D campaign.
Yeah.
Like, there were a lot of times where it felt like they were doing dice throws, right?
No, I can see that.
And it's like, Stitch Face.
And then these hell dogs come at you.
Yeah, do a perception check. There'd be a lot of perception checks in that book. Things lurking out of the dark. and generally it's very mission based, right, the plotting, especially once our heroes work out what they need to do. It's very much overcome these obstacles which get increasingly nasty.
Yeah.
To get to the final battle. Not that this is necessarily a problem. I mean, it can make plotting quite dynamic. You know, it's certainly propulsive and it keeps you turning the pages. And interestingly, there's some almost meta-commentary on it. So there's this character, is it called the Devil Boy?
Yes.
Yes, who... Yeah, again, in terms of, you know... It's odd, because I feel like the book probably does have quite a lot of issues with representation, but it really didn't trouble me in the way that, say, Box Trolls really did last week.
Yeah, I feel like it's quite... humane. Like, I feel, despite some of the issues, I feel like it's trying to acknowledge people's humanity and so on.
Yeah, I think so. And I like the fact that even when you get these incidental characters who are murdered off quite quickly, I think Wooding is very good at telling details or giving us quick but convincing sketch of this character. You know, all the characters do seem recognisably human, basically, you know, even if they're only there really for plot reasons.
Yeah, that I did want to talk about that actually, because okay, to try and explain. So there's sort of two big threats. One of them is the Witchkin, who we'll talk more about. And they're the supernatural horror who do all kinds of horrible things, but then there's also the serial killer Stitchface, who is a Jack the Ripper.
Oh yeah, he's character. Clearly modelled on Jack the Ripper.
So there's these kind of more supernatural horrors, and there's these horrors that are more based in the real world. Yeah, and like you were saying, we get to know some of the sort of incidental victims before they are horribly murdered in one way or another. And I think these characters bring the sort of real world based horror to life. Like we get, like Stitchface's first victim in the book is a woman called Mary Woolbury, who was sold to a workhouse as a child and then escaped and became a street sex worker. And we sort of just hear about sort of details of her life, and it kind of brings together the supernatural horror of the Witchkin, and also the real horrors of poverty, disease, slavery, war, corruption, all these things that are in the background of the book.
Yeah, I think that obviously you feel on side with the victims, but more than that, I don't really feel that you're vicariously enjoying the mythic Jack the Ripper. I mean, I'm very on-off with Alan Moore, I guess, as I think a lot of people on the left tend to be, that, you know, there are lots of things they like about Alan Moore and then lots of things which make them roll their eyes, I think. And in some ways, I was really impressed with From Hell. I think it's a much richer work than Watchmen, for instance, partly because it's such a sort of... I guess having done academia, I like all the kind of cod academia in it. But for those of you who don't know, From Hell in graphic novel form is quite different, really, to the film. And it's much more about the Jack the Ripper murders as psychogeography, essentially. So have you read it?
I haven't, no.
So it's much more about some myths around London and how kind of Jack the Ripper changed the psychological landscape of London, basically.
Okay.
So it's a very kind of clever work, but there are times in it where it does feel like he's taking a bit too much enjoyment in Jack the Ripper's killings in this slightly gleeful, seedy way that made me feel very uncomfortable. And, you know, this is obviously not uncommon in how Jack the Ripper is portrayed in media or in museums, that generally, I know there was a fair bit of controversy a couple of years ago because there was this Jack the Ripper museum set up, which seemed to be just reveling in his crimes with little regard to the fact that, you know, he horribly murdered several real women.
Yes. I was sort of weighing this up as I was thinking about this book, of whether we kind of Stitchface becomes a kind of anti-hero in a way, and I think it avoids doing that. So to explain, there's Stitchface and then there's the Fraternity. So Stitchface is a Jack the Ripper-like serial killer who murders women and mutilates their bodies. But there's another set of murders going on which imitate Stitchface's killings. And these are eventually revealed to be the work of the Fraternity, who are a cultist organisation who tried to kill Elizabeth. Right, this is why... this is why she has no memory.
And they're basically like the Rothschilds group. They're like the kind of possibly real, it's hard to say, conspiratorial elite group that you get in conspiracy theories.
Okay, I'm not familiar with
that, but... I've probably read more conspiracy theories on it.
But yeah, the fraternity are like a group of the elite and powerful and also strategically useful people who control the city, and their head is
spoiler warning.
His name. yes, a spoiler warning for all of this is a man called Pike, who is the director of the asylum. And he has this grand plan to bring about the Glaumeska, which is the new gods who will destroy the world, but hopefully save this band of cultists. And so the murders that are imitating Stitchface's murders are forming, their locations are forming the shape of the Chakmog.
Chakmog.
yeah, which is the tentacled cultist symbol that is also tattooed on Eliza Bell.
So that's obviously where we get the Lovecraft stuff in the book.
Yeah. The Chakmog is described as a stylized image of a many-tentacled thing seen in three-quarter profile, etched in simple blue-black ink. And the copy of the book that I had as a kid had that on the front, but my current one doesn't.
No, I've just got the one with the pentagram on the front, which is
isn't
nearly as exciting.
No, my one has it's quite a good cover. It has Eliza Bell, a sort of anime type style. She looks kind of haunted or possessed, as is appropriate.
Oh, well, actually, I think because I've heard, you know, a lot of talk of failed film adaptations of Eliza Bell Cray, and actually, I think it'd work much better as an anime.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the rhythms of it and like the character types and stuff just would suit anime far better than a live action film.
Yeah.
It's not dissimilar to something like Bleach in some ways.
Okay, I'm sorry. I keep not getting your references.
Oh, no. Okay, well, Bleach is this sort of mammoth long series about demon hunters, basically.
Okay.
So I haven't watched all of it. It used to show on the Freeview anime channel. And it seemed to be like one of the only animes they had license for. So they just like play it through the whole day, basically. But it's similar to Eliza Bell Cray in that, you know, all the demons are really horrible and horribly grotesque and such. But it has a similar structure that, you know, it tends to be discussing what the plan's going to be and then fighting a demon and then a bit of recovery and then a bit more discussion of what they're going to do next and then fighting another demon, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I've got a bit off track.
That's all right. I think I was, talking about Stitch Face
and the fraternity and the
So like the fraternity are kind of the people who are on top in society and have the power and money to protect themselves more from supernatural threat. And there's sort of extra horror that the head of the fraternity is the director of the asylum, so him and his agenda gets to decide who is sane and on. I don't know if there's like the temptation to see Stitchface as the anti-hero, like in opposition to the fraternity. But actually, I think they're shown to just be like two sides of the same thing.
I have similar thoughts. I mean, I guess in D&D terms, right? The fraternity are effectively lawful evil, and Stitchface is chaotic evil.
Mm-hmm.
So neither's really more evil than the other, although I suspect that Wooding's allegiances, if pushed, would be towards chaotic evil.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And because Stitchface does a win. he survives. And like at the very end of the book, in the epilogue, the very last line, we see that Stitchface is off to horribly murder Pike, who's the head of the fraternity. So he doesn't get any comeuppance.
Is it? Have you? I can't remember if I've ever made you watch Con Air.
No.
So Con Air being a very kind of sweaty, testosterone-drenched action film with Nicolas Cage. John Malkovich plays the main villain in it, who's called Cyrus the Virus, and claims that he has killed more people than cancer. Which is quite a claim. So Steve Buscemi in the film plays a serial child murderer and abuser, possibly. And he gets off completely scot-free at the end and is basically portrayed as, you know, all that wacky child murderer. It's really odd. Like, the other sort of evil characters in it, you know, yeah, they're definitely evil and they deserve their comeuppance. But for some reason, Buscemi's just used as the comic relief. And, like, at the end, like, similarly, I thought of it because it ends with him, the last shot is him gambling or playing cards, and it just ends with him saying, "I feel lucky," or something like that. Which is sort of enjoyably ghoulish, but obviously very troubling at the same time. I don't think it goes quite, I mean, I wouldn't quite say the book has the tone of, oh, lovable Stitch Face.
Yeah. But he does not get any comeuppance.
No. But hey, I guess in real life, or certainly in evil Victorian London.
So let me go back and talk a bit about the Witchkin themselves a bit more, because I think they're one of the most memorable aspects of the book.
Agreed.
So just like a few of the ones that we encounter. So there's the Cradle Jack, which is a kind of spindly-fingered child-eater whose scratch turns you into itself. There's the Drog, or Drowned Folk, whose presence is heralded by like ice-cold temperatures and the smell of the sea and the sound of wet flippers on floorboards and so on. And they want to drag you under the sea with them.
Yeah, that one's really, really got some shadow over Innsmouth.
from what?
The Lovecraft story, Shadow Over Innsmouth.
Oh. I do know that.
It's the one with the deep ones.
Yeah. Yes. There's the White, who lives in the shadows and whose touch causes instant necrosis of the body's tissues and shrivels it up.
Oh, those descriptions are really quite deeply unpleasant, actually, yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And there's the Dildegast, who places his stones on the corner of your house, and when he places his last stone, your house collapses.
Oh, that one's really great. Yeah. I find that bit. That was probably one of my favourite little bits in the book, actually. That was brilliant.
I love the bit because, so basically the fraternity's plan starts to work. They start the process of conjuring these old gods, and there's the darkness descends and permanent sort of shadow over London, and so all the witchkin can come out during the day. And then there's this great sequence of all the witchkin coming out and sort of various horrible things happening.
Yeah, should we read a couple of them? Because they are good. It was probably my favourite part of the book. So on my copy, it starts at 256. Mm-hmm. So I'll read the first one, and then hopefully by the point I've got to the end of it, you'll have found it. In her bed in Chelsea, the copywriter's wife, Clarice Banbury, woke with a shriek to see her husband rising from beneath the sheets of his own bed, lifting silently into the air. As the white shroud fell free, she saw in terror that his eyes were closed, that he was lying perfectly straight in sleep. Still shrieking, she saw the thing lurking in the shadows of the corner of the room, visible only in the murk of sleep-fogged eyes. Naked, twisted, an old, old crone, with her long straggly hair cloaking her bent body, she crouched on all fours with hooves for feet and a long tail twitching behind her. Klaus's heart had always been weak. It stopped altogether at the sight of the nightmare, taking her husband, and she sighed and lay back in her bed as if returning to slumber. She did not see her husband continue his smooth rise to the ceiling, dreaming of flying, until he was swallowed by the shadows up there. She was spared the slow, steady droplets of blood that began to spatter the beds, drip, 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 painting the white sheets in shocked flowers of red.
Yeah. Cool. I'll read another one. So good. Jimily Potter, master pickpocket at the age of 12, street urchin in the employ of Pete the Knife. He slept, twitching, in his cot in an empty warehouse, along with six other boys his age, who formed the rest of Pete's gang. It wasn't a bad life, stealing other people's purses, keeping a bit and giving the rest to old Pete. Apart from the occupational hazard of being hung, it was really quite rewarding. It was of the hangman's noose that he dreamed now, a gallows standing alone on the Yorkshire moors, the rope swinging steadily. He often dreamed of the noose, but he never remembered, just as he would not remember this one, which was remarkable because of a new element in it. There was a small child standing by the gallows, a little girl wearing a black funeral dress and a black cloak with a hood set halfway back on her head. He could see she was entirely bald. Her eyes were downturned at first, but when they looked up at him, he could see that her irises were red as blood, and her face was as cold as the grave. He awoke as normal that morning, stretched and got up to have breakfast. It was only later that day that the crimson fever began to make itself felt.
and the crimson fever is described horribly, like it kind of creates these rivulets in the flesh.
I think that's trench fever.
Oh.
There's two, yeah. Trench fever does that, and that is, yeah, pretty awful.
And it's not a nice place to live, the London of the Haunting of Eliza Belcrae, to say the least.
Absolutely, yeah.
I'll just read the last one.
Okay.
Franny Best, prostitute and mother, lived on the top floor of a two-story house. It stood alone, a little island in the centre of a particularly tight muddle of back streets. The property was the result of a helping hand from an appreciative client, who was also a landlord and who lived on the bottom floor with his wife. He had made a fortune from unscrupulous dealings in the developing areas of London, fiddling property boundaries to make a profit. Downstairs, he was sleeping soundly. Upstairs, Franny did not know what to do. For 20 minutes now, she had been watching the witchkin circling her house, listening to the soft scrape of its feet, watching it lumber slowly and awkwardly along with the great glowing round stone held in its big hands. 3 times now, it had stooped to put the stone down, each time at one of the corners of the house. 3 times it had walked away and returned with a new stone. It was a tall, mournful, dreadful thing, known in witch lore as a Deldegast. It took the shape of a narrow, lanky man in rags, his head bowed, his shoulders drawn as he carried his burden. Shuffling like a sleepwalker through the fog, it made a slow circuit of the house, and if Franny had counted, she would have noticed that it always made 3 circuits before dropping its stone. Now, as it approached the 4th corner on its 3rd trip around, Franny panicked. She rushed into her 2-year-old daughter's room, swept her up and ran. Down the stairs she went, her infant starting to squeal in her arms. Out of the door, her fear of the witchkin overwhelmed by her fear of staying in that house when the final stone was placed. The Dildegast placed its last stone on the final corner and vanished. A moment later, the house gave a groan and collapsed, burying the landlord and his wife, leaving only the stones, their glow dimming until they had faded to grey rock once more.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. Yeah, my whole... this whole portion of the book is just, like, underlines and, like, screaming in the margins. Just like, ah!
That's great. There
was a bit that actually made me, like, yelp out loud in fear.
Oh, what was that?
It's just... it's in the same bit. It's just one line, but... Children who had squalled in the night, there was something under their beds, were missing that morning, and only little dolls of them were left on their pillows.
that's like something from an Edward Gorey, particularly unpleasant Edward Gorey.
Oh, yeah,
story.
It is. Yeah, it totally is.
I think the bits I found most scary or dreadful... sorry, I don't know if scary is quite the right... If I read this when I was young, I would have found it scary. Whereas now reading it, it wasn't exactly scary. It was more just filled with dread and horror. But was the sequence with the wolf attack near the end in the tunnels when the wolves get set alight, which is just a horrible image and is described very vividly in a way that made me feel a bit ill when I was... As I say, I've been feeling, you know, been in the bathroom for most of the last 2 days. in a way, I felt an advantage feeling quite unwell reading this book, because there is a lot of physical suffering, and Virginia Woolf in On Being Ill talks about how you can't have true empathy for someone who is ill or physically unwell unless you're undergoing that currently, that as soon as you're not, your mind sort of forgets what it's like. Yeah. So, since I really was feeling very wretched, it was actually a weird advantage. That was the silver lining, that reading the book, shivering in bed, I felt I could have, you know, a little bit more empathy for the horrible trials and tribulations of our characters. But the other sequence, which I... was the only point at which I almost put the book down for a little bit, because I found it quite upsetting, is when Elizabeth is captured by the fraternity and is suspended in a kind of cage. Slowly almost, she feels like her skin is melting off her.
Yeah, so we haven't quite described what's going on with that. So the fraternity... wanted to use Eliza because her parents were involved in the fraternity, and then they took her sort of as a sacrifice.
Her parents are described as being dissolute in the same way that Oscar Wilde describes Dorian Gray as being dissolute, that we don't actually have many specifics about what they're up to, but we're informed that it's really, really bad shit, basically.
Yeah, they're really not... not upstanding members of society.
No, it said something like, I can't remember exactly the quote, but it's like, oh, some of which would make Stitch Face's stomach churn or something. And you're like,
okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, all sorts.
Yeah.
So, the fraternity take Eliza Bell to be their sacrifice, which involves putting this spirit inside her. And it's the spirit of an old woman called Thatch who is instrumental to sort of creating this apocalypse that Pike wants to bring forth. So, but sort of Eliza Bell has to be kind of slowly killed so that she has to be alive when the spirit's put in, but then she has to be weakened so that the spirit will overtake her own. So she's kind of drugged, and it's very, it's quite graphic and upsetting, basically.
I think he does a good job at getting across the horror of loss of agency, which, you know, is a real-world horror, and, the horror of, I guess, don't want to quite say dysmorphia, but, you know, this feeling of disassociation and feeling that her body's not her own and it's been taken over by something is described very vividly in a way that's quite upsetting, I think.
Actually, the sequence reminded me a lot of in Legend of Korra. I don't know if you've seen that.
This is clearly the podcast where we don't get each other.
The podcast voices. Where we don't understand. Yeah, but it's the third at the end of the third series. Korra is captured by the big villain of that series, and who wants to kill her when she's in the Avatar state. I realise that none of this really makes much sense to you, but
that's okay.
So that the Avatar is permanently killed, and so he drugs and weakens her. And ties her up, and anyway, it's very vivid and upsetting in a similar way to the sequence of Elizabeth in this book. Where were we?
I don't know if there's so much more to say about it. I mean, I don't think it's a book of monumentally deep thematics particularly. I mean, I guess in terms of situating it in a cultural context, it's coming really towards the end of that 90s goth scene, I suppose. Obviously, bands like The Cure have been around a little bit before then. You get that kind of industrial goth, like Tear Garden or Legendary Pink Dots, who I really like, who, I guess, take goth and then sort of make it even grimier, basically. Like, that always seems to strike me as the difference between 80s and sort of later 90s goth. The 90s goth is a bit more industrial, you know, and a bit more genuinely grubby than the slightly more romantic 80s goth. So, you know, I do think Haunting of Lisbeth Cray probably was the entry into goth culture for a lot of kids, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I mean, really, I should have become a goth.
Yeah, after reading this, I should have been a goth. But I've never had the work ethic.
I couldn't bring myself to commit.
Yeah, it's a shame, because, you know, I often feel like I like quite a lot of sort of goth culture. Like, you know, my favourite role playing experiences have been playing Vampires the Masquerade. And which is the most 90s goth game imaginable, frankly. And, you know, I like quite a lot of goth bands. But, yeah, I guess I've never been fully committed and divorced. Could I really wear a big top hat down the street? I mean, to be fair, I was a ghost tour guide briefly, so I did it then.
It's pretty goth. Yeah. You did literally wear a big top hat. Down the street.
Yeah, so. the streets of York, which I think is a particularly kind of goth city in its way, you know? I mean, it's touristy, but if you're walking around at night with all its snickle ways and cobblestones.
There are a couple more things I wanted to talk about.
Okay.
One of which is Kathleen, who I love.
She's a really great character.
She's like Thaniel's mentor. So Thaniel's like 17 and Kathleen is in her late 20s. And there aren't many witch hunters.
Like you, whose birthday it is today. Which
like me, whose 29th birthday it is right now.
So that means it's now time for you to grow up and become a witch hunter.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I definitely read Kathleen as queer. Which is my right, as it's my birthday. because she has like shorter hair and she wears trousers and it's very daring, and she's a witch hunter, which is a very, like, you know, not a very feminine occupation, and she's independent and so on. So I've taken her and decided that she is
I think that's all well and fair. It's time for you to start writing the fanfic.
Yeah. And I thought she actually had quite a... it was quite a touching scene with her and with the woman who is Leanna Butcher, who is the fraternity's last victim. So when Leanna Butcher dies, the Chak Morgue will be completed and the gods will be called forth and so on. And Thaniel tries to come to her aid to stop this from happening, but they and she doesn't die immediately, but they can't save her ultimately. And so there's a little while where it's only sort of her hanging on to life that stops the impending darkness from coming. And Kathleen's the only person who sits with her and thinks about her life and her humanity. And she thinks if she never awoke, if she kept on breathing but never awoke, why, that would be just perfect for them. They don't really see her as a person. And I don't know, I really like that scene. And I like Kathleen, like, sort of thinking about this ordinary woman and her life, and yeah, I thought it was a good moment.
Yeah, no, I think it's those moments of empathy with characters who in other books would be treated in a more disposable way, which is what elevates The Haunting of Eliza Bell Cray over what it could have been.
Yeah.
The you know, even though it does deal with slightly dodgy Jack the Ripper aesthetics and such, I think it's because of those moments that actually doesn't feel nearly as problematic as one might imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, and the other thing is the ending. So, like, going full spoiler, this book did come out in 2001.
true.
So during the book, Elizabeth is periodically asking about the Witchkin, sort of what they are and where they came from, and sort of people don't really want to talk about it too much. And then in the end, there's this kind of big sort of villainous reveal where Pike does his big villain speech, and he says that the Witchkin were created by humans. So it's like, he says, "We take all our sordid guilt, all our hate, all our shame, everything we dislike about ourselves, and we fashion ghosts to haunt us and monsters to plague us, and we don't even know we're doing it." So the idea is that humanity has entered the age of reason and is kind of having a collective mental breakdown at the idea that there is no one to blame for our misery and suffering but ourselves. It says, "In the deep parts where science cannot reach, we are afraid of the emptiness we are making for ourselves, the self-destruction we started. So we made the Witchkin, woke some ancient part of our minds that we did not know we had, and fashioned creatures out of our own nightmares to terrorize us. Because all this hate and guilt and shame has to go somewhere, Daniel, or it would eat us alive. Keep it in and we'd all be like Stitchface." So it's kind of a fairly frightening twist, right? Because we think we can protect ourselves from the fairy tale monsters through reason and logic, but actually it's because we're too invested in those things that we've created these monsters.
Which, I guess, this book being set on just before the kind of eve of the two world wars, thematically makes sense, right? That you have this moment of 20th century history in which, I mean, obviously of Nazism, it's tricky because you've got this kind of weird pseudo-spiritual stuff in there, but you know, you definitely would suddenly get this kind of mechanization of absolute cruelty and evil, right? That
And it's kind of transposing that to this the precipitating event is the imagined bombing of Britain.
Which seems like a kind of World War One kind of image somehow with these zeppelins.
And Pike's solution to this is to is to just scrap it, to just destroy the world and like bring back these old and hungry gods, and they'll form some sort of new world order. But I think the book somewhat suggests that the solution is more to do with making society more equal and less oppressive and less full of misery and poverty and the sort of real world horror that kind of feeds the supernatural horror, rather than just scrapping it all.
Yeah, in that way, it's got very similar thematics to the second Amnesia game, Amnesia: A Machine for Pigs, but I don't know if you've played that.
I mean, I'm just going to pretend that I have.
Oh, yeah, so
that, Yeah, cool. So on that reference that we both got, I think that's maybe...
keep it referential, spooky kids. Oh, God, I've met Nathan Barley. Like, you've seen Nathan Barley, haven't you?
I have seen Nathan Barley, yes.
Right, on with the credits.
So our theme music is by Meki Yamazaki. Our outro music is by Joe Kelly, and our artwork is by Letty Wilson, and I will put all their details in the show notes, and you really should have a look at their stuff because they're all very cool people and good artists.
Far cooler than us.
They would get all the references, single one.
Okay, and if you feel so inclined and you've enjoyed this podcast, please do go onto iTunes and leave us a kind review. Thank you.
Cool. You kind of did a sign off, but do you have a...
Not really. I'm off to Unitarian meeting now to make sure that, you know, I find a way of navigating myself in this godless society.
Cool. All right. Good luck.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.